You're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's 12 noon. It's now time for All Souls Forum.
Good day. Welcome to the All Souls Forum here on KKFI. Our program is titled, What's Happening in Jackson County? And I think that's pretty self-explanatory. Our speaker is Jackson County Legislator Scott Burnett. And he's going to give us basically a state of the county talk on this particular show. We're going to have our usual short introduction, then we'll go directly to Scott Burnett. And as per usual, we will take a break about 25, 35 minutes in, and then we'll resume with the question and answer session to round out the show today. So let's start with the introduction.
Today for the forum, we have Judge Scott Burnett. I just learned that today, that historically, that Jackson County legislators were called judges. And so Scott Burnett has been involved in politics most of his professional career. He is from central Kansas, around the Pretty Prairie, Fairfield area.
Yep.
Graduate from Kansas State in political science. He worked for the Martha Keys and Bill Roy's congressional offices in the mid-70s, and he served as field coordinator for the Carter Mondale campaign in 76. And from 77 to 80, Scott served as a special assistant to the Carter White House and was the Missouri State coordinator for the Carter Mondale reelection campaign. He is a partner in SGB Communications, a firm assisting clients with communicating their views to government officials, not anything that we don't do in this community. And today you get kind of a topical doubleheader. Scott was just recently spent Thanksgiving with Jimmy and Rosalind Carter, and so he asked if he could speak a little bit about some of that as well. And since Carolyn is in France, I'm taking the bully pulpit and making it a discretionary opportunity to let Scott wander where he'd like to go with his speech. So without any further discussion, I'll turn it over to Scott.
I guess we have to use this because this is on KKFI at some point. Yes, I'm Scott Burnett. I live on Valentine Road in Roanoke, just west of the trafficway, near Tom Benton's house. And I've lived there 23 years with my wife, Rhonda. She'll be 60 years old tomorrow, and so we're getting ready for that. I did grow up near Hutchison. The actual town we claim was Arlington, between Hutchison and Pratt, and cattle, wheat, hog farm. Got out of, went to K-State and graduated in 73. My first campaign was McGovern's in 72. But I always was intrigued. Very nice. We can't show that on KKFI. But it's a nice Wildcat mug. I remember in the second grade being intrigued by politics by looking at a $20 bill, because the White House is on the $20 bill. And I thought, oh, that'd be so much fun to work there. So I did work for Bill Roy. Do you all know of him, Congressman Dr. Bill Roy? He's 89 years old, same age as my mom. He was a flight surgeon in the Air Force. He's from Illinois and got sent to Topeka, to Forbes Air Force Base, and was Republican, went to law school. He's a doctor and a lawyer, and he got involved in politics in 1970, switched parties, and ran against an incumbent Republican from north of Topeka and was elected. And an amazing man. He's still a good friend, and he and Paul Rogers, a congressman from Florida, wrote the Roy Rogers Bill, which was the first HMO of the land. And so I worked for Dr. Roy, and then he ran against Bob Dole in 1974, and it was a very close race. Dole had just come off of being chairman of the Republican National Committee and Watergate, and he was badly damaged goods, and Dr. Roy just barely lost that race, but I think a half of one percentage point in Kansas. But Congresswoman Martha Key is a housewife. She ran as a housewife from Manhattan, was elected to the Congress. She did something that's never been done in the Congress before. She married a congressman after being divorced from her current husband. She married a congressman from Indiana, and that had never happened before. And people in the 2nd District didn't like that, and they voted her out after two terms in the Congress. But during that time, I met Jimmy Carter. There were 12 people that ran for president in 1976 because the Republican Party was so damaged. So a great trivia question is to see if anybody knows any of those names. And Birch Bayh, Fred Harris, Frank Church, Scoop Jackson, Jimmy Carter, George Wallace, Reuben Askew. There were 12 people that ran for the presidency in 1975-76. And you don't go to Kansas on the election year because you're wasting your time if you're a Democrat, but you come to Kansas in the odd years. So they all came to Topeka, and I worked for Congresswoman Martha Key, so got to meet them all. And I thought, I'm going to work for this Jimmy Carter guy. I like him. He's charismatic. He speaks well, and when he loses, then I'll go work for John Glenn. John Glenn was another one of the 12. And then just Jimmy Carter just never did lose. I worked for him as a volunteer in 75 and then on staff in 76 in field operations. Traveled all over America doing field operations in Ohio and Washington State, of course, in Iowa, where the caucuses just emerged after the McGovern campaign of 72. The caucuses became a big deal in Iowa and still are. Carter spent about 3 months in Iowa, 4 months, and now they spend 13 or 14 months campaigning. You'll see Hillary Clinton in Iowa all the time very soon, I'm sure, because that's just the way it is now. So I worked in the White House in the scheduling office. I was actually in the old executive office building. My window looked out onto the Hamilton Jordan's chief of staff office and was in the White House. If Doug had been a strong supporter and was going to be in D.C. and asked to see the president, you might get what's called a five-minute photo op. And that we would write up a page about who he was and what he had done for the campaign or what he did in Kansas. And then you come into the Oval Office and we'd take your picture, and it took about 5 minutes. And I did. A lot of my job was five-minute photo ops. I took Crosby, Stills, and Nash and I stay friends with Stephen Stills to this day. I took Lou Brock, the baseball player, came with his red shoes, red Cardinal shoes, to dedicate and get put into the Smithsonian. So my job was to take Lou Brock into the Oval Office for 5 minutes, and Carl Yastrzemski, and I took Fleetwood Mac into the Oval Office one day. So it was fun. And Joni Mitchell, the singer, writes a song, "You Never Know What You Got Till It's Gone." Well, when I speak to high school groups, I say, "You never know what you got till it's gone." Take advantage of every opportunity you can possibly have. One day I had the chance at the White House to spend the afternoon with Prince Charles. I said, I'll do that later. You know, well, there isn't any later. I had the I was telling our friend Jerry Riffle that one day, and he said, "I had a chance to spend the afternoon with Harry Truman," and I said, "Oh, I'll do that later." But there's never any later. So I tell kids, you know, use common sense, but take advantage of the opportunities that you have. So after Reagan kicked us out, I married Rhonda Bush, of all names. Who is a longtime family friend of the Carters, and she's from Decatur, Georgia. Brought her kicking and screaming out to Lawrence, and then to Shawnee, and now we've lived on Valentine Road for 23 years. In 1998, 2008, my friend Megan Tallman, who lives in Coleman Highlands, came to me and said, Henry and Ronnie are mad at the incumbent Jackson County legislator, and that was Henry Rizzo and Ronnie DePasco, so the state rep and the state senator from this area. They said they're mad at the incumbent county legislator, John Burnett. And why don't you, they can't find anybody. You're the fifth person but that they've asked, but would you run against John Burnett? So I thought, oh, that's kind of crazy. But I thought I would go ahead. So I went ahead and did that. I looked at the area, and I'd been real involved in neighborhoods and still am. I looked at the district, I looked at the voter base, and I knew a lot of people. And so we ran. I ran against John Burnett, and my wife had the idea, let's call the campaign Great It's Scott. So Great Scott. So that was the campaign slogan and on the bumper stickers and yard signs. We decided before we used Great Scott, we should check it out. Maybe it means some derogatory term, but the most famous military officer between the Revolutionary War and the Civil War was General Winfred Scott. And the Philadelphia newspaper started calling him Great Scott in the 1830s, is one of the legends. But so I ran. I was elected. There wasn't a Frank Palermo, who had been a city councilman, wore big hats and drove a Cadillac. He ran, but I ran. I won handily, the primaries are in August, and we don't have general elections. Most of the districts, you know, when you win the primary, you've won the race because this is such a Democratic area. So elected in '98. There were Victor Callahan was one of the legislators that was already in office, and we didn't like each other. We didn't like each other. We don't like each other much to this day. He was the chairman of the legislature, so I didn't get any committee assignments. I didn't get much involved in the legislature for a while, and then I started receiving I'd be on committees, finance and audit, or various committees, and I've served as the chairman of the Jackson County Legislature twice, January 1st will start the 16th year. Jackson County was founded in 1826, and as Doug said, the county commissioners, there were three of them. They were called judges, and we think that's maybe because they had the power to marry people, and they would ride around the circuit of Jackson County. So there was a presiding judge, an eastern judge, and a western judge. And the most famous judge, of course, of any was Harry Truman. Charlie Wheeler was a judge. Harry Jonas, who ran the Health Care Foundation. Charles Curry, the real estate man, if you remember him, were all county commissioners. Then in 1970, the voters voted to change the form of government, and that passed. Harold Fricken, who just died this year, wrote a charter, and the elections of 1972 were the first elections with a new form of government. There were 15 county legislators in that first charter, 15 districts, and the city council's talking about going to 12 districts and not have any at-large seats, which I think is crazy. 15 county legislators. We have 9 now, and that's plenty. But if you had 12 city council people that were each in their own kingdom, you'd have so many. You'd have 12 people trying to do their own agenda, and so I think the 6 and 6 that the city council does now is a good situation. We have 3 county legislators at large: Teresa Garza Ruiz, Crystal Williams, and Fred Arbanez. Fred's been there since that first time the charter changed in 1973. He's in his 40th year. And then we have 6 in-district. I'm the first district of Jackson County, and there are 5 others. We're going to have some change this year. Teresa Garza is not going to run again. She's going to run for city council, most likely. And what Jackson County does is, you know, the typical government functions. We assess and collect taxes and distribute them. We have parks. We have sheriff's patrol. We have the combat, which is unusual, the tax to fight drugs. And that raises about $20 million a year with half-cent sales tax. Mike Sanders has become very interested in transit, as you know. And I see that Ron Acapulco, my friend, is speaking here on the 12th of January. He'll give you a good summary of the transportation for this region, much better than I can do. But Mike Sanders has been promoting more than any person so far the regional transit. And then that kind of got dropped, and we were greatly pressured to put a health care levy on the November ballot. And it didn't, the more and more people looked at it, it just didn't make any sense. And 86% of the voters, as you know, or 84% voted against it. And I'm sure we couldn't find any of the 14% that voted for it. I'm sure they don't exist. Well, the zoo folks, Randy Wiskoff and Carol Hawquist is, Alan Hawquist live over in Jansen Place, and she works at Hallmark. She headed up the campaign to pass a zoo tax. And she was very thoughtful. She did polling. She came to us to put it on the ballot. And over about a two-year period, and it made sense that medicine people, the health care people, came to us. I first went to Children's Mercy on May the 10th, and there was the head of the Children's Mercy and two or three doctors, and they showed us a PowerPoint presentation about this translational medicine. And it was fascinating. And I think medicine in America is going to change incredibly dynamically in the next couple of years. What they showed us is that you're able to, if I get a cancer, there's some reason I'm getting that cancer. There's some antibody that's absent from my body. What they do with this medicine is they take cells out. They call them T cells. They enhance them with the antibiotic that should have been there, and they put them back into you. And it's remarkable medicine that some of the children that have leukemia that are almost to die, they take the cells out of them, enhance them, put them back in, and they recover. I think cancer research is on the verge of incredible change in this world, and that's a good thing. But what they wanted us you to do was to vote to put another tax on the ballot and to raise $40 million a year to be divided between four entities. Well, that's not a drop in the bucket for medical research. I mean, it sounds like a big number, but it's not. And it shouldn't be done just in Jackson County, but we got a lot of pressure to put it on the ballot. Let the citizens decide. Well, most of the time when you let the citizens decide, you get bombarded with a campaign. And we were bombarded, over $2 million campaign, but people just didn't buy it. And so, and I think it's for the best, but it is remarkable medicine. I'm looking forward to seeing how it rolls out in coming days. Tell you a little bit more about let's see, how long have I been, Doug?
You got another 10, 15
okay.
minutes. I suppose you go longer since there's not.
Yeah. I'll tell you a little bit more about Jimmy Carter. I did meet him in March of 1975 and worked for him those 5 years. I've stayed in touch with him, been to Plains quite a few times. As Doug mentioned, I've done Habitat with him 9 times somewhere in the world, northern Thailand, the Philippines, and my dad went with me until he got so ill that he couldn't go anymore. My dad's deceased 5 years. But Jimmy Carter and my dad are the same age. They're both in the Navy. They're both farmers. They don't have the first nickel they ever made, but they've got the second one. They are frugal men. So, Dad called me in 1994, four and said, let's you know, Jimmy Carter, let's go do that habitat thing. So we went to the Indian nation up in South Dakota. We went to Eagle Butte, South Dakota, build houses, big houses with big basements because there's just no housing on these Indian reservations. And when they get these brutal winters, there might be 20 Indians in one house. And so we built huge houses with big basements. And Tom Brokaw was there. That's his home state. And we spent time with him, and that's fun. And then throughout the next 20 years, Dad had been in the Navy off the Philippines in World War II. And so he wanted to go back there, so we did Habitat in the Philippines in 99. Los Angeles 1 year, and then Garth Brooks started joining us. So he's been on the builds every year with Teresa, whatever Garth Brooks' wife's name is. She's a famous singer as well. But it's always interesting to see who shows up. So the cost of doing a habitat build with Jimmy Carter was your transportation and then a modest $200-$400 for your housing. And lots of times we slept in tents. 3 years ago, we did our last habitat build. My wife and I went to D.C., and we did a build, and it was about $800 plus transportation. The next year, they went to Haiti. They went to Haiti 2 years in a row. And Jimmy Carter gives 1 week a year to Habitat. Well, at Haiti, they wanted us to pay our own airfare to Atlanta, and then we're going to take a chartered 767 to Haiti, to Port-au-Prince, and they wanted us to pay $2,000 apiece. And the management at Habitat had changed, and they were going to start using this volunteer opportunity to make money. So we didn't do it. No, we didn't go to Haiti. Next year was Haiti. We didn't go. And then this year it was in New York, Denver, and San Francisco, and they wanted us, you know, like $2,500 a piece. So we didn't go. But Rhonda's from Atlanta. I thought we should go down there and see old friends. So in about 3 months ago, I made the reservations for 10 days to Atlanta, and I emailed my friend Jay at the Carter Center. So we're going to be in Georgia for 10 days over Thanksgiving this year. We haven't seen President and Mrs. Carter for 3 years since the D.C. build in 2010. And Jay usually gets right back to me, but I didn't hear anything and didn't follow up very well. But then about a month before our trip, Rosalind Carter called Rhonda and said, Jimmy and I know you're going to be in Georgia. Would you spend Thanksgiving Day with us in Plains in our home? And we said, yeah, we can do that. And so we spent the night before in their home for about 4 hours. And we didn't talk politics. We just talked about old friendships. And Rhonda's Jeff Carter is the youngest son of Jimmy Carter. He's about 60 now. Rosalind said, you know you're old when your children are applying for Social Security, because that's Jeff's the youngest, and then there's Chip Carter and Jack Carter, and then little Amy was the one that some of us remember from the White House. So we talked mostly just about family, and we didn't talk. He had just gotten back from monitoring an election in Nepal and travels like he's a teenager. He'd been back 4 days from Nepal. The next day after Thanksgiving, we spent that evening with him, and then the next day we went to a neighbor's house in Plains for Thanksgiving meal, and then he wanted to show us this tricycle. It's an exercise. It's got a little wheel on the front, two wheels on the back, and you stand on it, and you push off, and you transverse like you're skiing. And people have seen them advertised on television, so they both have one of those. He's 89 and she's 86, and they ride it 2.5 miles every day. So he's a remarkable man. We talk some physics, and I'm a political science graduate, but I know about Bernoulli and Venturi and Pascal. So we talked some physics for a little while. And yeah, he was a nuclear engineer on a submarine. So it was a fun time. The next day he was going to go quail and dove hunting, and it was kind of cold, and his boys didn't want to go. And he said, well, I'm going whether you're going to go with us or not. But he's an interesting man. He does not like you saying that he's the best ex-president we've ever had. He thinks he was a good president and also a good ex-president. But he thinks he did got quite a bit done. But it was a painful presidency. That last year when the hostages were in captivity was a painful, painful year. So I'm going to run one more time for Jackson County Legislature. The elections, the filing starts in February, is open for a month. I've had an opponent twice. Twice I've ran without an opponent, so we'll see. You never know. And a lot of what I do in Kansas City is of my own choosing. We make $25,000 a year. It was $15,000 when I started. The county executive makes over $100,000. He's got a lot of direct reports, and I have one staff person. I pick and choose a lot of what I want to do, and I work a lot in Midtown. Work a lot on Troost. In May 1st, I called my friend Jennifer at Operation Breakthrough, and I said, "I've got three good pieces of furniture that I'd like to contribute to Operation Breakthrough because I knew they had a." She said, "Well, we can't. We've got a really nice truck, Scott, but we don't have any drivers." So, I've been driving Operation Breakthrough's truck since May the 1st, probably about 40 hours a month. I pick up stuff, put it in their warehouse, and then on the second Saturday of each month, moms from Operation Breakthrough can come and get furniture. They're given a voucher to get two or three pieces of furniture. And everybody know Operation Breakthrough? It's the largest daycare center in the state of Missouri. It's at 31st and Troost. It's two 80-year-old nuns started it 42 years ago and are still at it. Sister Berta is there every day. Sister Carita just retired. But it's 400 kids. Most of their are the children of single black mothers, and they take two or three buses to get there every day and two or three buses to get home. And they bring their kids there, then they go to, work at McDonald's or somewhere and then come back and get their kids in the evening. But it's been nice having a truck, and I've been able to coordinate. Like, there's a group here in town. I think you'd really be interested in speakers committee. There's a group in town called Society of St. Andrews. They glean from the fields. And it started by two Methodist ministers in Roanoke, Virginia, about 30 years ago, I think. But we have a Society of St. Andrews West. And all throughout the year, from the time bok choy is ready to pick in April through November, they glean from the fields. And I'm on their board. They'll send out an email on any given day saying, come and can anybody go to Bonner Springs and pick up 300 pounds of tomatoes that are ripe and need to be used now? And so I can't go very often, but I did go to Bonner Springs this year and get 300 pounds. And then you can distribute them to any food place you want to, St. James Kitchen over on Troost or Restart or City Union Mission. Well, this year, Society of St. Andrews picked millions of pounds of, lots of times it's already picked and you just have to distribute it. But for the second year in a row, the Society of St. Andrews was given everything that was in Carolyn's pumpkin patch out by Liberty north of Worlds of Fun. They were given all of there's 60 acres of pumpkins and squash. And after Halloween's over, they're given the squash. This last year we picked 50,000 pounds of squash on one Saturday. This year we picked about 300,000 pounds. So I went up there on the Monday after Halloween and drove a forklift all day, loading boxes into semis. But I took the box truck from Operation Breakthrough and I loaded it up with 4,000 pounds of squash. So that next day on Tuesday, my friend. Jesse and I went to 14 social service agencies and gave them squash, mostly 100 pounds, 200 pounds, one organization, we gave them the entire box of 1,000 pounds. But it's interesting. And so, and that was just, that was 14 social service agencies just in this area, right around here. There's, and the need's incredible. I took some to Crystal Ray High School, some to Operation Breakthrough, and a bunch of other places. So I'm involved in a lot of stuff like that.
You're listening to First District Jackson County Legislator Scott Burnett, and he's telling us what's happening in Jackson County and what might be happening in the future. Let's take a short break. We owe you some messages. Let's do those, and then we'll come back with some questions from the audience. You're listening to the All Souls Forum here on KKFI.
Taller than the others, this man walked among them at a distance, now and then calling the angels by their secret names. He would see that which earthly eyes do not see, the fierce geometry, the crystal labyrinth of God, and the sordid millings of infernal delights. He knew that glory and hell, too, are in your soul with all their myths. He knew, like the Greek, that the days of time are eternity's mirrors.
The Soul-Seeking Journeys of Scientist Emanuel Swedenborg. On From Ark to Microchip. Wednesday at 6:30 p.m. here on KKFI 90.1 FM, Kansas City Community Radio.
And I will start with a question that Carolyn asked me to ask. And so since Carolyn's not here on her behalf, I will ask this question. She's, and I don't remember the particulars, but a few years ago, you were mentioned in the Star for having the best proposed legislation that wasn't enacted. And she wanted you to expand on that and talk about that piece of legislation that was so good that no one even thought it, that they should implement it. So here you go with that.
Well, what she's talking about is the Patriot Act. And, you know, it was bad legislation 10 years ago now. Michael, is it? Yeah, 10 years ago. There's controversy in the Jackson County Legislature when we bring something up that's not a county issue. Particularly, there's two Republicans on the Jackson County Legislature, Greg Grounds, who was the mayor of Blue Springs, and Bob Spence, who was a CPA, lives in Lee Summit. He doesn't like it when we bring up stuff that's not germane to Jackson County. And so when I bring up what I brought up was a piece of legislation to oppose the Patriot Act. And I had a hearing, an hour-long hearing, and I stacked the deck so it was all of our, you know, people against the Patriot Act. But one of the U.S. attorneys in Kansas City showed up as well and to support it. But the pitch then that year said it was the best piece of failed legislation. But it and it wasn't germane to Jackson County, just like translational medicine isn't particularly germane either.
I was wondering, when you became a judge or a representative, legislator, what was it that you hoped to accomplish for Jackson County? And in that same vein, since you're running one more time, and I assume that means you're not going to run again after that, what is it you would hope to be able to do in your last term for Jackson County?
The reason I entered public service was an extension of what I did in the neighborhoods. We just need to work more together. We're all in this together. I have a small bully pulpit that I can stand on. It's that tall, but we've just got to communicate better. There needs to be better use of the resources out there. And what I hope to do is nothing specific, but it is more that we communicate and we work together. It's more that I had somebody come to me about a month ago and say, can you find me 50 flu shots for some of the people that come to my community center that don't have money for flu shots? So I was able to do that. And so I actually was able to find 150 flu shots. So if you know anybody that needs one, we've still got some. But there's no specific legislation that I hope to pass. What I'd like to accomplish in the next 4 years is, next 5 years, is that we better work together. We've been involved with some, I think there's a group over on Troost, and be another fascinating speaker is, there's a group on Troost now called Connecting for Good that helps bring internet service to poor people. And it's been doing amazing work because it's becoming more and more, we're becoming more and more divided. Google's only in this for the money. And if you're at East of Troost, you don't have enough money to pay them. And so Connecting for Good is a group that's helping give low-cost internet service. I've been working with them. I helped introduce them to Troost and find their office over there. A lot of what I do is put people together. And hopefully there's a better good comes out of that being together.
Scott, let me, I've been following the Airport Terminal Advisory Group. And that comes on the heels of experience with the Mayor's Bi-State Innovation Team regarding using Google, and then before that, Superintendent Covington's Strategic Planning Group. So I've had some experiences with these attempts at community discernment and the degree to which they end up representing a lot of pressure of the type you described with respect to the transitional medicine, or in fact lead us to kind of rebalance the table in ways that will allow us to be more together in the future. Transportation is another example. So my question is this. It seems clear to me that a sensible arrangement with respect to KCI would be to move to a regional transportation authority. Let the city have the 8,000 acres that are not airport, but just take that kind of mature piece of infrastructure and let it run, more or less an automatic like it has been for a long time. But my question is, from the perspective of the Jackson County legislation, how might you or the county go about advocating for that kind of an adjustment? Is there any way that can be done?
There's already a state legislation and some federal legislation, the way I understand it, for the ATA, the Area Transportation Authority. And what could be done there is to expand that legislation through Jefferson City to include the airport, to include rail and airlines and buses, seems to me. Yeah, it would take a bi-state, and I think that authority is already somewhat in place.
Scott, one of the county's chief responsibilities is to administer and collect the property tax for the scores of government entities that rely upon it, and this is a topic I know you're probably more knowledgeable about than hardly anybody at the county, but it's been a fairly rough year for administration of the property tax, and I want to ask you a two-part question. One is, is there some vision that you might have about how we could migrate away from dependence, such heavy dependence upon the property tax, which is particularly difficult for lower-income folks and is particularly hard on lower-income school districts? So is there some other alternative tax that you would want to promote? And secondly, how can the county what improvements do you see the county can make in improving administration of the property tax?
Yeah, I really don't have a sense of migrating away from the property tax. I really don't have an answer for that. Do you have ideas? Yeah, that would make sense. Well, the property tax this year was a nightmare. I remember it was a Saturday, May the 4th at 2:25 when my phone started ringing. And Coleman Highlands had received their property tax, the neighborhood. It was just a nightmare. I can't for the life of me imagine why they didn't at least show some of us that are out on the street what they were planning to do, because it was so cockeyed. It was so unfair, and there was no rhyme or reason to it. I think there'll be a lot more care taken. The guy, Ed Stoll, that's the head of the collections and assessment now, I think is going to be a lot more careful. But that was that caused a whole lot of hardship for a lot of us. You know, probably 100 calls that I handled and 100 cases that I worked up. I don't think that we'll see a time like that again. But it is an area that, you know, Catherine Shields tried to, you know, remember double property taxes 10 years ago, and there was a firestorm there. A different problem, but the same outrage. And the Hyde Park was just so affected, and most areas of town that they really suffered from it. It really caused a lot of stress. I still have people come up to me and say, you know, it's 8 days before the new year that they didn't appeal. They didn't get around to appealing, so they're going to have to deal with that. And so if you know anybody, we can look at that again. We can't this year. We can't in the next 8 days, but next year we can look at that again if people didn't get around to appealing in 2013. Yeah, the question is absentee ownership an issue? Yes, very much so. Properties that are neglected are oftentimes owned by somebody in California. It is a big problem. You agree? Every day. Yeah. Well, thank you for having me. Yeah.
I'm not trying to get you to speak to changes in transportation, but you mentioned that Mike Sanders has a great interest in transportation, and I'm wondering if there is a future to greater county involvement in transportation, since the need is so countywide.
He's the first county legislature, the county executive, the first one that's taken an interest in looking at it countywide, and it probably should be bi-statewide, as we've just talked about. But I think he's touched a nerve where a lot of people say go for it, and the problem is going to be the money. It's just there's decreasing federal money all the time, and so I'm not sure. And with the railroads don't seem to be buying into it, I'm not sure we're going to go in, where it's going to go. Mike's going to run for attorney general in 2016, so it'll be unclear whether whoever takes his place has that same interest in transportation.
I'm always concerned about government entities and government entity overlap and redundancy and so many governmental units. In Wyandotte County, the city and the county merged and have streamlined a lot of their activities. What are your thoughts on those types of endeavors?
I went to K-State, and Riley County has been combined government for years and years. I think it's a great idea. I'm not sure you're going to ever find enough people in the county or in the city to agree with that, but I think it would be a great idea to combine the services.
There's been a fairly long, tempestuous relationship between the city and the county over use of development tax incentives. What's your view on that, and how do we reconcile these competing interests between the two government entities?
I think the rub is becoming less. I mean, I think there's been better communication between the city and the county, but I'm a fan of tax increment financing. But I think you have to have some accountability. I think the biggest problem, and the problem the county has with it, is you can't show me that it's actually doing what it's supposed to do. That you can't show me the increment, and you can't show me the tax from the increment. And I think that's where Mike Sanders and his staff that attend the TIF, the increment meetings, I think that's where they've had the problem, is show me how the money is really being used. My sense is that it's getting better.
I was curious about the success of the Truist Alliance and if that could be replicated in other parts of the city.
Yeah, the Truist Alliance is a 7 or 8 year old organization that meets on the fourth Wednesday of every month somewhere on Troost. Father David at Reconciliation Services on 31st Street and Deacon Ross Burgoyne of St. James, just retired from St. James Catholic Church, started the Troost Alliance. And it's, and I'm kind of, there's no officers, there's no dues, but we meet on the fourth Wednesday of every month from 11:30 to 1. And it's 40 or 50 people on Troost that have an interest in the communication, like I talked about earlier. And I have kind of become the secretary for the group. My assistant and I do the notices. We help find the locations. Whoever hosts the, whatever building we're in usually provides the lunch. And so there's no charge for the lunch. There's, but it's a great networking. That's where Connecting for Good has made, they've helped us set up a website that we didn't have before. We were using Google, the Google group for notices, and we now have a website, TroostAlliance.org. I think it's been a wonderful experience. We met sometimes at the police station, one time at Telefaro and Brown, which is at 8th and Troost. We often meet at the Discovery Center because they have a real nice meeting room. I don't know if we could duplicate it or not. I used to be a member of the Midtown Presidents Association when I was the president of Roanoke. We would meet once a month and look at common problems, try to craft solutions to common problems. And everything kind of, I believe, Ecclesiastics, you know, everything has a time to live and a time to die. And it looks like 10 years is about the cycle, of things before they become stale. They kind of go away. I'm on the board of the Historic West Bottoms, and that's businesses down there. So they meet once a month, and then the Northeast Chamber meets once a month, and Marty Lee's Southtown Council meets once a month. So to some extent, that is happening. The Troost Alliance is being duplicated around town to some extent.
Scott, I'd like to thank you for coming in today. The weather hasn't been the greatest, but I thought this was very informative.
You've been listening to the 1st District Jackson County Legislator, Scott Burnett, telling us about what's going on in Jackson County and what's going to happen in Jackson County in the near future. Hope you've enjoyed this edition of the All Souls Forum. Tune in again next week, same time, same place. This program was recorded on Sunday, December 22nd of 2013 at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Kansas City, Missouri. It is Kansas City's longest ongoing conversation, and we are proud to present it for another year here on KKFI. This program was edited and produced for broadcast by Barry Lee. Thanks, as always, to Rita Norton and the staff at All Souls for helping us produce this program each week here for you. You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Ever wonder why Washington is so obsessed with deficits? Meet Pete Peterson, the billionaire who spent almost $500 million to get politicians to focus on the deficit rather than jobs and economic growth. He's aiming at Social Security and Medicare cuts. On this week's Heartland Labor Forum, we're dedicating the entire show to exposing Peterson's Social Security eater. UMKC's Max Skidmore and Social Security Watch's Eric Hingson will help us do that. Thursday, 6 p.m., rebroadcast Friday, 5 a.m.
Congress to the unemployed. Eat confetti. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With my weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. Is this really how we want to start the new year? By denying unemployment benefits to more than 1 million Americans who've lost their jobs? The bipartisan budget agreement passed by Congress and signed by President Barack Obama protects military spending, but promises to throw the most desperate in our economy into increased financial hardship, thrusting hundreds of thousands of families beneath the poverty line. The long-term unemployment rate is at the highest it's been since World War II, while the percentage of those receiving the benefits is at its historic low. Meanwhile, Wall Street bankers are popping the cork, celebrating a banner year for the stock market. As brokers await their bonuses, many more of the unemployed will head for the breadlines.
This is the wrong thing to happen at the wrong time for our economy.
That's Amara Jones. He's the economic justice contributor for ColorLines.com. He served in the Clinton White House, where he worked on international trade policy.
Jobless benefits are actually stimulative to the economy. They are actually add for every $1 we provide to someone for unemployment benefits, it yields $1.60 in economic activity.
People living on the edge financially spend what they have to get by. Those in the top echelons of society, the top 1%, can take their income and hold on to it or stash it away into an offshore account. The unemployment insurance program traditionally grants 26 weeks of replacement pay for workers who lose their jobs through no fault of their own. The extended benefit, signed into law by President George W. Bush, lengthened the time period to up to 99 weeks. Benefits average just $300 a week. According to the Washington Post, the average job search lasts 35 weeks, so the current 26-week benefit will create added stress on families already struggling. Congress could renew the extended benefits. Senator Jack Reed, a Democrat of Rhode Island, and Senator Dean Heller, a Republican of Nevada, have put forth a bill that would preserve the extended benefits for 3 months. Heller said in a press release, "Providing a safety net for those in need is one of the most important functions of the federal government. As Nevada's unemployment rate continues to top the charts nationwide, many families and individuals back home do not know how they're going to meet their basic needs," he wrote. Although this proposal is bipartisan, it's expected to be blocked by Republicans when it comes to a procedural vote around January 6th, unless five more GOP senators can be convinced to support it. Even if it passes the Senate, the bill would still face a House of Representatives controlled by Republicans who are generally hostile to any extension. On the other end of the economy, a year-end stock market rally is expected to boost the massive bonuses Wall Street's preparing to hand out. The largest Wall Street firms have reportedly set aside more than $91 billion for year-end bonuses. In response, an activist group called the Other 98% has launched a petition calling on employees of Chase, Citigroup, Wells Fargo, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, and Bank of America to donate their bonuses to the 10 million Americans displaced by the housing crisis. Alexis Goldstein worked for years on Wall Street and now is the communications director for the Other 98%. She told us on the Democracy Now! NewsHour,
"We had a proposal to take $60 billion and fund something called the National Housing Trust Fund for 2 years. This is a program that was actually created by George Bush in 2008. It's a program that, if funded at $30 billion for 10 years, could end homelessness in America."
Goldstein points out the bonuses are essentially publicly financed because Wall Street banks obtain funds from the Federal Reserve at very low rates. These banks also can afford huge bonuses, she says, because
they continue to commit crimes that are very profitable. There was a huge settlement this year with J.P. Morgan that was a $13 billion settlement that was the result of mortgages that they sold during the crisis that were very shady and were misrepresented. Investors actually lost $26 billion on that, so $13 billion sounds like a big settlement, but it's actually just a fraction of the money that people lost. But then you have things like J.P. Morgan manipulating electricity markets and charging consumers in California more money than they should be because they're manipulating the market. We saw credit card fraud. We saw J.P. Morgan fined for that to the tune of $300 million. So I think the second answer to the question is they're still doing things that are criminal that actually happen to be highly profitable.
Inequality entered mainstream public discourse through the activism of Occupy Wall Street. The cold economic reality of it is hitting more homes this week as unemployment benefits expire. Congress can and should renew them. Whether it does depends on people who care speaking out. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
This week on The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
Ask yourself whether the wounding of the whole earth isn't the same wounding that takes place for us as individuals when we face that kind of loss.
I'm Neil Harvey. Please join us this week when we explore how human health and the health of the earth are intimately linked with our guest Michael Lerner on The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
Friday morning at 9:30, right after Between the Lines.
Welcome to World Ocean Radio.
I'm Peter Neal, director of the World Ocean Observatory. Heritage refers to practices or characteristics that are passed down from one generation to the next. I may have long misunderstood the definition, conditioned to think that heritage is embodied only in places and things, in castles, churches, and monuments, in paintings, and other physical remnants associated with the great events, institutions, and movements in our history. The United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, known as UNESCO, is the international agency charged with identification and protection of such places. Many of you will be aware of the World Heritage Site designation, a list of the monuments and cultural remnants considered the most important worldwide. To see all these places in a lifetime would be an education worthy of the time, energy, and cost of getting there. There is also a second designation of, quote, intangible cultural heritage, unquote, defined by the UNESCO Convention as, quote, the practices, representations, expressions, knowledge, and skills, as well as the instruments, objects, artifacts, and cultural spaces associated therewith, that communities, groups, and in some cases individuals, recognize as part of their cultural heritage. This intangible heritage, transmitted from generation to generation, is constantly recreated by communities and groups in response to their environment, their interaction with nature and history, in the form of oral traditions and expressions, performing arts, social practices, rituals, and festive events, knowledge and practices concerning nature and the universe, and traditional craftsmanship, unquote. Here are the four ocean-related practices, paraphrased, from their UNESCO descriptions. In Belgium, 12 households in Oostenkerke actively engage in shrimp fishing using Brabant draft horses walking breast-deep in the surf, parallel to the coastline, pulling hand-woven funnel-shaped nets held open by two wooden boards, with an attached chain dragged over the sand to create vibrations, causing the shrimp to jump into the net, to be emptied into baskets hanging on the horse's sides. The events take place twice a week, except in the winter months, and culminates in a two-day shrimp festival for which the local community spends months building floats, making costumes, preparing street theater, and introducing shrimp catching to over 10,000 visitors every year. In Iran, lenge vessels are traditionally hand-built and are used by inhabitants of the northern coast of the Persian Gulf for sea journeys, trading, fishing, and pearl diving. The traditional knowledge surrounding lenge vessels includes oral literature, performing arts and festivals, sailing and navigation techniques and terminology, weather forecasting, and wooden boat building. Iranian navigators could locate the ship according to the positions of the sun, moon, and stars, using special formulae to calculate latitudes and longitudes, and special vocabulary to estimate water depth, type of wind, and the characteristics of approaching weather. In Mali, the San Kaimon collective fishing rite takes place in San every second Thursday of the seventh lunar month to commemorate the founding of the town. The rite begins with the sacrifice of roosters, goats, and offerings made by village residents to the water spirits of the Sankey Pond. The collective fishing then takes place over 15 hours, using large and small mesh fishing nets, followed by a masked dance on the public square, featuring Bulwa dancers from San and neighboring villages, who wear traditional costumes and hats decorated with cowrie shells and feathers, and perform specific choreography to the rhythms of a variety of drum. In China, beginning on the fifth day of the fifth lunar month, people of several ethnic groups throughout the nation and around the world celebrate the Dragon Boat Festival. The festivities vary from region to region, but they usually include a memorial ceremony offering sacrifices to a local hero, combined with such sporting events as dragon races, dragon boating and willow shooting, and folk entertainments, including opera, song, and unicorn dances. Each one of these events, and the 200 more on the list, strengthens the tangible bonds between the participants' families, neighbors, and visitors. Each is based on the harmonious relationship between humanity and nature, individual imagination and collective creativity, community and cultural diversity, revealing, conserving, and communicating a vivid sense of cultural identity that we can see, touch, feel, and celebrate. We will discuss these issues and more in future editions of World Ocean Radio.
World Ocean Radio is a project of the World Ocean Observatory. Visit us online at worldoceanobservatory.org. World Ocean Radio is produced in association with WERU Community Radio, Blue Hill, Maine.